The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pear.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of Zach on Film. Joining me like always is Steven Schleicher.
Hello.
And joining us like most of the time, Rodrigo Lopez.
Hey man.
Hey. So, we're jumping back to the summer of 69 again this week. We watched, what did we watch last week?
Oh, last week we watched The Wild
Bunch. And this week we're trading horses for motorcycles as we watch the Tom Hoffman, Peter Fonda starring movie Easy Rider.
You mean Peter Fonda, Dennis Hopper movie?
Did I get that wrong?
Yeah.
Really nailed those last names.
Yeah, directed by Dennis Hopper, produced by Peter Fonda, written by Fonda, Dennis Hopper, and Terry Southern. Although Southern would go and say, I don't know so much about Dennis Hopper and Fonda getting all the credit that they got on this. But
yeah, that was the weird thing I read about it. They were like, he did nothing. He gave us a title. And then he was like, I wrote most of it.
It was
really interesting.
Yeah.
So this is a movie that I think I was first introduced to. This is the first time I've watched it.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe the first time I'd ever heard of the movie or had anyone discuss it to me was in your editing class.
Yeah.
Because everyone's like, Easy Rider. I go, yeah, the thing where they like mash the editing board or something so they could do transitions between scenes.
Uh-huh.
So I was very interested to kind of watch this movie for the first time. And boy, what an experience this movie was.
Yeah, what did you think? First of all, give us a rundown of the story.
Okay. Shouldn't take long.
And then I want to get your reaction to it.
Okay. You can pretty much do this story in like 5 seconds.
Okay, go for it.
Guys sell cocaine. They bank a bunch of money. They're going to retire in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Bad stuff happens along the way. Rock music plays over them, driving motorcycles across the country. They die.
Okay.
There's some stuff I missed, but really, it was like, I watched. So the drug selling thing happens right at the beginning of the movie,
right?
It happens 5 minutes. We're out of that. They're on their motorcycles going across the country. And then it's like 40 minutes of them riding their motorcycles across the country with some interstitial stuff in between. But it would be like, hey, we're at this hippie commune for a good 10 minutes. And then we're going to play a song. We're going to ride our motorcycle some more. So that was an interesting dynamic that I didn't see coming in this film. Because everyone's like, oh, Easy Rider is this really wackadoo movie about drugs in the 60s and these guys riding motorcycles. And it's just weird and weird and crazy. And I was like, when are we getting to the weird? Because I know we're doing this thing for our scene transitions, but this is pretty straightforward. And then you get to New Orleans and things get a little wackadoo.
I told you
that
when you get to the part wondering what drugs they were on, they were on all of the drugs.
All
of
the drugs.
In that New Orleans bit.
Yeah. Rodrigo, had you watched this movie before?
I hadn't.
Oh, okay.
This is the first time I'd seen Easy Rider.
So was your overall impression of the first half of the movie kind of what I'd explained?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I kind of maybe expected that from what I had heard and B, this moment in film. Like when we go through the first long motorcycle montage, I'm like, I bet this isn't the only one. It's just like them like riding their motorcycles and cutting to like countryside and then like, oh, they're kind of joking around while they're riding.
So part of this is Peter Fonda was, I guess, doing motorcycle movies at this time, right? He was known for doing motorcycle films, and he had committed to doing, I think this one was his final motorcycle film that he had to do for the studio.
Okay.
And so he's like, okay, here's what I want to do. And they went out and did Easy Rider. And of course, I was going to ask you, Zach, which version of the film did you watch? Because apparently the first version of the film is like 4.5 or 5 hours long.
I did not watch that.
And they cut it down to 1.5 hours. And most of the footage that is missing that was taken out is gone forever. Like, there's about 1 hour worth of stuff of them in Southern California as stunt performers in a circus, and they're being ripped off by the man. And so that's why they start selling the drugs. And then there's sequences of them trying to get out of California, running into biker gangs, all sorts of different things that are going on before we get to, you know, that's in the first 5 minutes.
Right.
That's expanded to 1 hour in the quote unquote original cut of the film.
That was also something I read. It didn't go into the detail like you just explained of what was missing, but they did say, you know, Fonda started cutting this movie. It was like 3 hours long at first. And then they're like, they ripped out all of the backstory.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need backstory for this. What we're trying to get across to this thing, which I thought was an interesting choice, because you are kind of wondering, why are they leaving all this sweet drug money behind? And, like, what are they doing besides, like, we're going to Florida? I think it plays into this kind of off-kilter nature of the film to not give you all of that story and just kind of let you experience them driving across the country. But it's definitely something that would not be allowed today. They'd be like, okay, all those scenes with those dudes riding the bikes, you got to lose those. We got to know what these guys' names are. Where are they from?
Well, but let me ask you, because I think that when you examine this film, their backstory means nothing, right? Everything you need to know about these guys is their drug deal and the fact that they have lots and lots of money.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're getting out of town. They're going to go and retire and lead the easy life, which, and this is the weird part when you start examining this movie, the easy life is what this movie's about, right? Is trying to achieve this American dream of retiring in Florida and having all the money that you need. But in the process, it's wrapped up in this counterculture experience where you're exploring all of these different lifestyles that are going on in the world at the time, going on in the United States at the time, and how they clash with one another. And we see this in this movie. And in fact, this is probably, like, I don't know, the fourth time that I've watched the movie for prepping for Zach on film.
Mm-hmm.
And it suddenly struck me that Peter Fonda actually is a representation of America in this movie. I mean, he's got an American flag helmet. Mm-hmm. He's got an American flag on his jacket. He's riding a motorcycle that's got America red, white, and blue all over it.
Well, I think even in one of Roger Ebert's reviews of this film, he did like 4, he only refers to Fonda's character as Captain America.
Well, and that's, I mean, we don't know that his name's Wyatt. I mean, I don't think they mention his name Wyatt. Dennis Hopper's character, Billy, introduces the two as, this is Captain America and I'm Billy.
Yeah.
And I think that is in reference to their stunt work that was cut out of the film earlier on.
Yeah, he does refer to him as Wyatt possibly once, just like he just calls his name. And I think, like, seriously, it's like once in the movie he calls him Wyatt.
And if we look at Peter Fonda as a representation of America, we get to see this clash of cultures through, quote unquote, America's eyes, right? We get to see the hippie commune, right? We get to see what the hippies are all about and what are they doing? Is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know. Peter Fonda doesn't know. America doesn't know.
And he kind of doesn't care.
And he doesn't really care. He's like, fine, they can do whatever they want. I mean, he goes and he meets a very strict Catholic family with lots of kids living on a farm. And America says, you know what? You're doing good for yourself. You know, good. You should be proud of what you have. Good for you. Counterculture, or the commune people, do whatever you want to do, man. It's totally cool, right? They get to Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And they start running into bigotry and hatred and just, you know, this is what the Deep South is like. And this is what America is what Peter Fonda is thinking throughout the entire movie. This is what America is. And then a friend of theirs is killed, right? By these rednecks. In fact, these two guys are killed by hatred. America is destroyed by hatred. There's a great line in this movie that I really had to think about. It's after they go to the Louisiana and they have their big drug-induced trip, and they're really, really thinking about, you know, what their lives are. And Dennis Hopper is like, hey, man, we're living the dream. We're going to Florida. We got all of this money. We're going to retire rich. We can do whatever we want. And America says, after viewing everything that he has seen, no, we ruined it. Or we wasted it or whatever. We blew it. You know, he's saying America, we as a culture have blown these fantastic opportunities from everything that I've seen. And so that just hit me upside the head today. It's like, holy crap, that's what that line, that's what he's referring to in this. Is this is America in 1969. Again, we talked about this the last time. America's just going through this whole turmoil of stuff and literally tearing itself apart. And here's a film that I don't want to say is a morality play, because that would make this a conservative film and not a and not this this wild, crazy film that it is. But it's basically saying, hey, look at all these people and how they're acting, and why are we acting this way, and why are we making such a big deal out of whose hair is this long? Why are we killing people? Why are we shunning people that are living a different lifestyle? Why are we doing any of this stuff? We blew it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the ultimate message that you get out of Easy Rider, is this examination of America in 1969. Through the eyes of someone who represents America.
Is that kind of what you took away, Rodrigo, from the we blew it line that they utter right at the end before they kind of meet their final fate in this film?
Yeah, I think that's one way to see it. I think it's also, interestingly, you can see a real bent towards kind of the more moralistic type of movie making, right? It's like, these are guys that are mostly portrayed as your protagonists. You're following them. You're right there with whatever shenanigans they're getting into. But they die at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of have this like remorseful moment. And it's like, it's almost like going back to that, like, the comics code and the real stringent like TV guidelines is like, if anybody commits a crime, they have to be punished at the end, right? Mm-hmm, it's like, mm-hmm. You can't have criminals that get away with stuff. So although I don't think that that's what they were going for, they wanted this like tragic ending. It's funny that it still fell into line with like that classic,
right.
That classic, like stringent, filmmaking guideline.
It would, and I heard that when they were writing it, and I don't think they ever shot this scene, but their original ending for it were the two make it to Florida by a boat and kind of sail off into the sunset, which, I think if you look at it from your view, Stephen, if you look at Fonda's character as America, mm-hmm. you could read that into, we have blown it as America in a lot of areas. But we're going to get through it eventually. We're going to rise above it or, in their case, kind of escape it. Do you think that would have, I mean, obviously it would have changed the ending and what it kind of meant, but what would have this movie, its impact would have been if this final two characters hadn't died in such an abrupt, act of hatred, but kind of actually made it to their goal and rode off into the sunset?
I think, and as we'll see next week, I think it would have ended kind of in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is not, doesn't have a happy ending. But there is this moment at the end of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid where their antics throughout the film were kind of romanticized and popularized, which is why Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid has made much, much, much more money than Easy Rider did, in 69. I don't think it would have been as powerful because I think people who were watching this movie really understood that, yeah, look, we're just trying to lead the life. We're all trying to be Easy Rider, right? We're all trying to just relax and do our thing, but there's always people in the way blocking us. So I think it reinforced with that ending, it reinforced everyone's feelings of the time of, yeah, man, and it doesn't matter who you are in this when you're watching this film. You don't have to be a hippie or an LSD user or a biker or whatever to watch this film and understand that, hey, they represent me. I think it would not have been I think it would have been a hollow ending if they had had the happy ending, because at the time everyone's like, we don't get a happy ending. Look, people are dying in Vietnam. We're not getting any of this good stuff. I think that ending really reflects what people were wanting. And that's one of the things we talked about with the film school generation, is they were creating films that reflected what they wanted to see and what audiences their ages wanted to see.
Yeah, I think Easy Rider throughout all of it kind of has this sense of like these characters trying to escape. And that ending does give you what that generation at that time felt, right? That there was no escape. There's no big payoff at the end. We've been told that there is. Mm-hmm. This whole time we've been told that, you know, there's the American dream and everybody can achieve it or something. And you just see people being shipped off to die. Mm-hmm. You see, you know, markets crashing and all these things. And there's an entire generation that just feels like they have no power. Here's a movie about these two guys trying to get their power back and they die. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like there's no escape.
Yeah. I can imagine when you think about what's going on in the studio system at this time, they're very much like, hey, we're making movies for everybody. We're making movies that a young kid can go see and a grandparent can go see. Everybody's going to love all the movies that are coming out from us. And again, if you look at some of the other films that were coming out in this year, Hello, Dolly, Paint Your Wagon, Honor Majesty's Secret Service, Boy Named Charlie Brown. These are all movies that are like really just vanilla, happy-go-lucky, whatever, you know, movies that come out. But then Easy Rider comes out and people are like, what is the studio? They're like, oh, this looks like crap, man. We're never going to make any money on this deal, but we've got to fill a hole. So let's send it out in the theaters. And suddenly it just blows up. And then the studios are just like, what is going on? Why are all these people seeing this movie? And then suddenly they realize, oh, this is what audiences today want to see. Oh, maybe we should start creating movies that cater to specific audiences. And so Easy Rider flips that switch for Hollywood that realizes we can create films that are not specific to everyone, not general for everyone, but can be very specific for groups of people. Mm-hmm. And they can still be very, very successful. And maybe we should listen to some of these young kids like Dennis Hopper, who looks like a drugged out hippie. Well. And maybe they know what they're talking about, because now they're making us filthy rich.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, again, when we look at some of the movies that are coming out now, we're looking at some of these movies that are remakes of counterculture movies or examinations of the times, like The Wild Bunch. And it's the studios trying to recapture and bank on that money again in a modern age. And it's just really, really weird to think that they're repeating the same mistakes that they did in 69, just, mm-hmm. you know, 40 years later.
Well, and the thing is that it just like weirdly never, it's like movie studios are always doing the same thing, right? They try to find a formula that works and then they just, mm-hmm. milk it mm-hmm. until it stops working.
Mm-hmm.
And by the very act of milking it is that it stops working. So, yeah. And then something comes along and it's like lightning in a bottle, right? Mm-hmm. And then they try to repeat it and it never quite works, but it does kind of give people a little bit more opportunity to breathe and express themselves for a little while before things get structured again.
Right.
So it is interesting to see kind of these like weird projects that just kind of like crack a new area open and then allow people to kind of like flourish in a lot of ways before everything calcifies again for another mm-hmm. 5-10 years.
Mm-hmm. Now we'll be looking at in a couple of weeks Midnight Cowboy, which actually made more money than Easy Rider. It's number 2 on the list of the biggest money makers of 69. And that came out before Easy Rider by about 2 months, I want to say. And it's another one that when we get to it, it's really examining, here's the other side of what you think America is in that time period. And so I think that this, hey, let's examine this other stuff, mm-hmm. is really good to see in films. And even today, when we look at representation, when we look at LGBTQT films, when we look at films that Steve McQueen puts out, I mean, those are examinations of things that, you know, your normal audience may not want to go and see, but we go out and celebrate them anyway because we're looking at things and trying to understand things from this different point of view. So I think it's really important that films like Easy Rider can kind of, and Midnight Cowboy can pave that way of saying, hey, here's, we can celebrate all of this other stuff out there and examine it and look at it and enjoy it. It doesn't have to be cookie cutter factory films that the studios are putting out all the time.
Right. One character that I think might be more attachable for a regular film going audience is Jack Nicholson's character of George that gets picked up about halfway through this through this movie. And he meets Fonda and Hopper in jail after the two have been booked for parading without a permit, which is the one thing I want to be arrested for in my entire life.
Yeah.
He is recovering from a little alcohol binge in the jail. He's obviously been there for a long time. And he helps these two get out, and he hears that they're wanting to go to Mardi Gras, and George's like, well, I've always wanted to go, but I've never made it past the state line. And so he decides to hop on the bike with old Fonda and grabs his old high school football helmet, and he starts taking off with him. And he seems to be this character that we get to know these two more through. He, you know, he tries marijuana for the first time with them, which I don't know if it was supposed to come off as a cheesy, almost don't do drugs kids kind of scene when it started, because Fonda's like, here, George, try this. Yeah. And George's like, oh, I don't know. I've never tried it. Is that marijuana? Boy, howdy. Oh, I can't believe it's this. And so you know, he brings an interesting element that brings when he's in there, I think gives a different tone to the film. So why do you think his character was so important to keep into this film?
I've got a theory, but I'll let Rodrigo go
first.
Okay. Well, I think that this character is, you know, he's a kind of rural America guy that is not bad. Like, I think he's an important character because you don't want to make this movie about trekking across America and, you know, encountering bigotry and just kind of bad people, and to say, oh, okay, well, city's good, country bad, right? Or, you know, north good, south bad. So here's a character who is from the country, and he's a good guy, you know, and he's a better guy than these two even. You know, he's just like a guy who wants to go to Mardi Gras. He's got a little bit of a drinking problem, but, you know, nothing that an overnight stay at the local sheriff's won't cure. And I think he's kind of like, he's a positive person. And he also, like, fills them in on a lot of the stuff that's happening in the area. I think he's basically meant to be, to say this is also part of the American experience. Just because you're from this area doesn't mean you're automatically going to want to shoot somebody as you're driving by them.
So what's your theory, Steven?
Well, I agree with Rodrigo in that if you look and see what he's wearing, and I don't remember when the Andy Griffith Show was running, but remember Otis the Drunk? In that show,
slightly,
he's always wearing, he's like this, wearing this white, like, seersucker suit all the time, which is kind of what we see Jack Nicholson's character wearing, is this white suit all this time, or the off-white suit. And so it's almost like, hey, you guys who like this middle America homespun stuff, here's a guy that represents this. But you know what, middle America, you've got a lot of problems as well. You've got drinking problems. You claim that, you know, marijuana is bad, but you really, you don't know about it. So you're willing to try things. And then you're also very nervous about things that are strange. And this is why he has this big, long speech about aliens and the conspiracy that aliens are living among us. And so he just kind of, he does represent this middle America of conspiracy and fear of things unknown, because he's afraid of marijuana, afraid of the aliens coming down. It just, he seems to be paranoia, the representation of things that are afraid of change, but you'd go along with it if you can be convinced to do it. And America's telling me that that marijuana is okay, so it must be okay, especially because America tells me that drugs are not, that marijuana is not addictive. He tells me that marijuana doesn't lead to heavier stuff, but then he gives me a funny look when I say, I don't want to get, I'm already addicted to booze. meaning that booze is the addiction, marijuana isn't. So it's really kind of this weird, I agree with Rodrigo, in this weird middle America, curious paranoia that goes on.
And,
he's not bad, but he's also just not really opened up.
This element to the character that understands where, you know, Wyatt and Billy are coming from and understands what they represent, that they're not this, I don't know, like anarchist counterculture revolution where they're just dudes with long hair that kind of want to get along in the same way everyone else does. And he has this, I mean, one of his long, he talks more than any character in the entire film, is talking about how people are afraid of them because they're free, mm-hmm. and that you can talk about all the freedom all you want in America, but once mm-hmm. you actually start living it, then that's when people start getting afraid of you. And so he has this idea where he's self-aware in that he understands that notion of America, but he doesn't live outside of it. He's still, mm-hmm. you know, he still has his hair cut short. He is, you know, he's a lawyer. He works mm-hmm. in the town. He's kind of just doing the paint by the numbers thing where he grew up. Maybe a little bit different. You know, he was like a lawyer for the ACLU and things like this, and he kind of befriends these two. But he's definitely aware of the system that America is operating on, America the country, not the character, and but still operating inside of it because that's the way, and he's probably expected to live, especially mm-hmm. if he's from the Midwest.
Well, and two, because he's telling the police that keep him in jail, or like, hey, don't tell my parents about this, right? Because my dad, who must be a big to-do guy, should know about any of this stuff because I don't want people knowing that I'm a troublemaker or anything like that. So you're right, he is trying to keep up appearances.
But then, you know, he is the first character to die also. He dies in a more personal way, really, than our final two characters die who, I mean, they get gunned down while they're just driving on the highway. The people who end up killing George are these guys they saw in a cafe, you know, a mm-hmm. few miles back down the road that they stopped in and didn't weren't able to get any food because, you know, everyone is suspicious of what they look like and they're calling them all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he gets beaten to death ever to survive. But he, you know, he is the first casualty of this type of thing. So in the larger scope of what this picture is trying to say, is it just saying, like, even people that are associated with this are going to feel a hate? Or what's kind of the message that Easy Rider is sending here?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, there's always this collateral damage, right, to hatred. It's even if you direct your hatred up at a particular group, we all pay the price, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, George is really the most pure character in this piece, you know, that we spend any time with. And he dies because he just gets associated with these people. And they're not necessarily terrible guys, although they are probably, you know, obviously by their own actions, like cocaine dealers, but
selling, you know, to Phil Spector nonetheless.
Yeah, I know. God, freaking Phil Spector being in this movie. Like that, forget the LSD scene. That's like the biggest trip in this movie, seeing Phil Spector. But yeah, it's this idea that when we are violent and unaccepting, we all pay the price, I think.
Right.
So I think this movie, and you know, it's the first time I've ever experienced it, was talking about an editing class. And this movie came out, a few months after Bonnie and Clyde. It's after kind of the French wave stuff has started mm-hmm. over across the seas and starting to migrate into American film. And you can kind of see that in the editing sequence, which I don't feel like they really played up as much as it is almost made out to be. There's only a few scenes where they're doing the back and forth cuts and stuff.
Right.
So from a stylistically put together way of this film, I don't know if it really pushed it as much as it was probably taking its influence from.
So one of the things is the editors realized that was a gimmick that they were using.
Okay.
And they realized that if they're going to use it, we have to use it at the right time, right? So the first time we see that edit happen, Peter Fonda is looking at his watch, throws it on the ground, and we're cutting back and forth really quick between the watch on the ground mm-hmm. and them driving off on their motorcycle. Literally things that are happening at the same time, right? Next time we see it, we're seeing a flash between late afternoon and evening, right? So there's a bigger time gap that happens. And then even later, there's an even bigger time gap. And I think they use it four times, maybe three times. But the last time we see it, Peter Fonda has a flash to his own death, or the audience is given this preview of his upcoming death. And so we get an even bigger jump in the flash forward, flashback element. So I think that there is a deliberate reason why they're doing that in there, to give the audiences a little bit more understanding of what's going on. But they're also using that sparingly so it doesn't grow tiring, because each time you do it, it's sending a message to the audience. So if you're going to use a gimmick, don't overuse it. And I think they did that right here. I mean, yes, it did seem odd at times when it did happen. But then when you think back on what was going on between those flashback, flash forward, it makes a lot more sense that that perception of seeing ahead and seeing down the road is more important for America to know, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So do you think they used it well already go? Do you think they could have done more to push that element of the film? Because it's definitely not, you know, when you think of like Jean-Luc Godard's Breathless and they're cutting as they're driving, which was the kind of the big thing. They don't really do much with their driving sequence. It's pretty much a by the numbers, you know, drive down the road type thing, besides transitions, really. So stylistically, I don't know. I guess I had maybe played this film up too much in my head. And I guess we're not even getting to the LSD stuff, because that's just know, just craziness.
Right.
But, you know, for the most part, it was pretty straightforward. Do you think that helped the film? You think it could have pushed it a different direction?
I don't know. I think there's a blankness to this film. I think there is, aside from those like sharp, returning cuts. It's all pretty straightforward. You get very little information about the characters, and it's just filled with like wide, long expanses of like just scenery or these characters just kind of hanging out. I think that this movie, you know, made the correct decision. They were like, well, do we keep all the story, or do we keep all the like shots of them riding around their motorcycles? And the reason why that was the right decision to keep that is because the movie allows you to fill in whatever you want, right? It's like everybody kind of relates to one of these two characters in some way, especially Peter Fonda, because he says very little. They have like almost no lines. It's like you can just put whatever you want in his head, and he's not really going to do anything to contradict it.
Right.
If
you're looking at it from the America perspective, he's the observer.
Yeah. Both from the formal aspect and the story aspects. Like, this movie leaves a lot open for you to fill in, and that's I think that's why this movie was successful, partially that, and really representing the counterculture in an even way, if not necessarily a positive way, then at least a non-judgmental way, I would say. And then letting you kind of make a decision based on a character that, you know, maybe smiles a couple times in the movie and once time says like, yeah, let's do that.
Right. The music was a big part of Easy Rider, and I was surprised that this is actually one of the first films, not the first film, one of the early films that didn't have its original score, but was just dropping in, you know, popular music of the time, you know, some Bob Dylan, Jimi Hendrix, bands of that time. And I was really, I mean, that was a big part of, you know, them driving across the country is all this music playing on top of it. Which, you know, is kind of the quintessential road trip thing of music playing in the background all the time. But I was interested that this actually kind of got, it was one of its main kicks in the film industry from Easy Rider.
The budget for this movie, just for the film, $360,000.
Yeah.
Right. The budget for the music licensing, $1 million. So to license all of that music for this film, which I think is important because, again, it's also music that represents the culture.
Yeah.
Costs three times the amount of the film itself.
Which is great.
Yeah.
It's like, without this, you know, Quentin Tarantino might have actually had to score like any one of his films instead of just taking all the music in his head and dropping it on there or anything that comes out, you know, like Suicide Squad. And
right.
None of those movies might have.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe not. I was trying to think of if there are other movies that did this, and at The only one that came to mind was American Graffiti, but that came out in 73. This came out in 69. You're right. Martin Scorsese, when he was doing Goodfellas, used a lot of music at the time. But, you know, that movie's much later. This may be something that did that first or did it probably best. I mean, there are always other movies out there where it's like you're watching some detective movie and they go to a ballroom and Benny Goodman is on stage playing. You've got a whole musical number there. Right. But to have your whole musical soundtrack wrapped up this way is really maybe one of the first times.
You know, and I was watching this and I was thinking, especially when you get into New Orleans and they go to this, you know, this whorehouse that Nicholson's character had recommended. And, you know, they're with these girls and eventually like, hey, it's time to do that acid the commune gave us. Let's go. And, you know, first off, I go, let's make a rule, everyone listening. No one do acid in a cemetery.
Yeah,
it's just like the worst place to do it,
right?
Yeah, it's just the weirdest. And, like, I think, you know, I like the look of, you know, like Louisiana, Florida type cemeteries where all the things have to be above the ground.
Yeah,
it's like a different
flooding,
it's a different look to a cemetery than anything you see out here. But it definitely adds a little bit more of a creep factor to it. So let's never do acid in a cemetery. Let's all just agree, because that obviously did not work well for anyone in this film.
And the biggest problem was when he was given the acid, he was told, do it with the right people.
Yeah.
And if you're doing acid or mushrooms or anything like that, you have to have someone there as your guide.
Like a drug Sherpa.
Something like that, yes. And they didn't have this. It's like, hey, we're drunk. We just met you like 30 minutes ago at the whorehouse, or we've been up all night.
I think they were up all night.
Let's all do acid together, and no one knows what's going on. And so, yeah, it just leads to this total breakdown of their group, where they're just totally freaking out over everything.
Yeah, it was so strange because, you know, leading into this, they're, you know, at this house that has like all of this religious iconography all over the place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Fonda's character seems to be, you know, kind of mulling all of that over in his mind. And that's when you get the flash forward real quick to his burning motorcycle in the end. And then, you know, when he's on this trip, I think he's like in the arms of Mary or someone.
It's some statue.
Yeah, and so it seemed like they were really playing heavily into that religious aspect during this part of the film. And, you know, what does that say about Fonda's character, Rodrigo, that that's kind of what he gravitated toward during this portion of the film?
It's nothing. It says nothing because it's just like, oh, here's a guy who has a complicated relationship with religion. It's like, insert your own thing here. You know, I mean, it really is. Like, it really allows you to say, like, oh, he's like me. He wants to be religious, but he feels that the thing, like, pushes him away. Or, like, oh, he's like me. Like, secretly, he's religious, but, you know, he has friends who aren't, so he has to keep it quiet. Like, whatever you want.
You kind of feel the same way, Steven. You think there's anything more to that in that scene? I mean, it's all so chaotic that it's almost hard to pick out any really through line of that entire, you know, 10-minute sequence.
Yeah, I think
there's
you're just being inundated by everything, and I don't think you're supposed to have to come away with really anything in that except maybe here's your last wild, crazy bacchanal or whatever before the end times happen. So just go for it. Just go crazy.
Yeah, you know, it was during that time.
Yeah, if it was made today, Prince's what is it? 1999 would be playing.
It was during that time. When I was watching it, you know, when I started this, I was surprised it was a relatively short film, you know, 1 hour 40 minutes, not, you know, drastically long by any really measure of time during film. And it was during that time, especially that sequence and kind of just reflecting on, it was a very sparse film. There's not a whole lot happening through it that I thought, you know, I think maybe this is, if you're going to do something weird, I think you should put a time limit on it. You got like 1 hour 40 minutes. If you're going to make something just kind of off the wall, not your standard, you know, traditional story structure. If you're going to do weird things with your cinematography or editing or your special effects, if you're really going to throw something out there that people aren't regularly going to the film, the theater, you know, week in, week out, put a nice cap on your time there and make sure you can hit it. Because I think especially when you get into, you know, like Terrence Malick's films or anything that's kind of this ethereal kind of notion, you push like two 2.5 hours. People are like, okay, we got to get some form of a story that we can follow along for this time. So I think that was one of the good things they did, cutting it down to, you know, taking 2 hours out of that original cut.
Part of me wants to, though, just see what that fabled 5-hour cut of this film is.
Because you like torturing yourself and sitting in front of TV that long?
This movie is a performance, right? But it's almost like a stage performance where, hey, some people are going to come out and play some music for you. Bom, ba-bom, bom, bom, ba-bom, bom, right? And now someone's going to come out and say, the family, and give you this long dissertation on what the family unit is supposed to be.
Mm.
Then some more music. Bom, ba-bom, bom, bom, ba-bom. And then it's going to be the hippie commune. What is it? What is it about? Bom, ba-bom, ba-bom, ba-bom. And then racism, bigotry, hatred. And so it's like people, and it's what it is. It's little stories telling you, here's what's going on, interrupted by these musical moments that you can kind of wake up and be interested in. I want to see the other statements that they're making about America that were cut out. Because apparently in one of the sequences early on, they run into a black biker gang as they're trying to get out of California. I want to see what that's all about. I want to see this whole interaction that, you know, apparently there's a 20-minute chase scene where they're being chased by the cops from Mexico to California. I want to see if there's a statement being made there.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I kind of want to see that. I want to see those other statements that they're making and see, you know, what America thinks about all of that at that time. Because I think it'd be very interesting. But I also don't know if I could sit through a 5-hour film
we're going to get
to, and that's why when we wrap up this Summer of 69, this Something of 69 streak, we're going to be wrapping it up with Once Upon a Time in the West, which is like 3.5 hours long.
I'm going to start it this week.
You probably ought to. Yeah, Once Upon a Time in the West. It is. I want to see what the tire running time is. It's over 3 hours. 165 minutes.
Oh, that's a little under three. Doable.
It feels like 3 hours.
Oh, great.
Especially in the middle.
You know, we just did a little segment that people can listen to if they're a super special Major Spoilers person.
Mm-hmm. If you're a Patreon member at patreon.com/majorspoilers, or if you're already a VIP member at members.majorspoilers.com, you'll be able to find some bonus commentary.
Yeah, yeah. And so we talked about this list the BBC put out of the top 100 films since the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't seen the original list they did of like top 100 movies in the last 100 years or something. But is Easy Rider one of those films that's going to stand? I mean, obviously, we're still talking about it. A little over 50 years
so
later?
About 50 years later.
Is it still one of those films that's going to last and going to be relevant and worth watching again in another 20 years?
Do you think it has that
statement that of what kind of it was and its place in America and its place in film history?
I think so. I think so in 20 years. Now, in 100 years, if they go back and look at the top 100 films of the last 200 years,
yeah.
I don't know, because we don't know what's coming up in the next 85 years. So,
but do you think it's one of the top films you know, like in the 20th century, Rodrigo, in that kind of, you know, first half century of film being created, is it one of those that people absolutely need to watch?
I think it gets a lot of things right, but there's a fundamental Americanness to it that might be an issue for non-Americans because they won't necessarily know what exactly is going on here.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fundamental 60s-ness to it that is might be an issue for people that didn't know what exactly was happening at the time, or you know, don't really have an in to that. But I think, like I said, this is a movie that weirdly executes its negative space really well, gives you very little and allows you to like really fill in the blanks. So remains entertaining, even though it unless you really hate shots of like the American countryside and bridges. So I think that it could stand the test of time, especially because some of the themes in the film remain relevant. Some of them have come back around and become relevant again. And some other ones that are not, that are just sailing right past our heads right now may again become relevant in the next 10 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. Who knows?
So this was I was glad I finally got to watch Easy Rider. I think it's definitely...
Did you like it?
Yeah, I really did. I really did enjoy it. I thought, I think it hit a lot of interesting notes throughout the film. And, I think if you have a main character that's not going to talk very much, I think they have to at least be doing something interesting. And I think Easy Rider pulled that off well for the most time. I think on some level it was a little too overt in what it was trying to say, especially when he blows his tire at the beginning and you have this shot of like, we have our motorcycle on the back and we are changing its tire. And this is a farmer. He is pounding a horseshoe onto a horse. And we're going to put them in the same frame so you can juxtapose where America is going and where it has been. I think like some stuff like that was just like a little too much.
But also, not only is it saying, here's how far we've come from horse to motorcycle.
Yeah.
But it's also showing the appreciation of something that is essentially a one-man vehicle. Right. Mm. Because a horse, because you see the farmer is like, that's some sweet ride you got there. He's really appreciating the fact that they have this. He's putting a new shoe on the horse because if you're going to ride your horse, you want it to have a shoe on it. So there's this kind of also, hey, there's also some oneness between us.
Yeah, right? That's good. It is like this. The motorcycle, I think probably more than any vehicle that we have right now is this symbol of like
freedom.
Yeah. It's like it used to be like a bike or it used to be just a car in general, but now it's the idea of a motorcycle is this freedom. Well, and that's probably the horse a long time
we
ago.
Could do a whole series on motorcycles in cinema, because if you go back and look at Marlon Brando in what was the movie in 1950s where he's part of the motorcycle gang, it's kind of the same way. This motorcycle represents something that's different, something that doesn't conform to what society expects, and certainly Marlon Brando's character, and I'd have to go and look at it, slips on my mind at the moment, is also that same way. Outcasts, outsiders from society.
So did you ultimately enjoy this film, Rodrigo?
I did. I actually enjoyed it a lot more than I expected to. I think I'm like, The Wild Bunch is a long movie and there were boring stretches during it. So I was going in expecting that to happen, and weirdly it didn't. Like, this movie has some long stretches of panorama, and riding around and everything, but it never really overstays its welcome. Right around the time when you're like, okay, this has gone on for too long, it's like back to a vignette of the adventure. The only thing that I felt went a little long was the tripping scene. And really, that just went a little long. So, yeah, I surprisingly found myself weirdly enjoying this movie.
Yeah. The Brando movie that I'm thinking of is The Wild One from 1953. Two rival motorcycle gangs terrorize a small town after one of their leaders is thrown in jail.
Oh, no. So, I think 1969 has kind of treated us fairly well so far, Stephen. Yeah, what's it got up next
I
for
think
us?
So, I mean, when we look at films of the 1960s, I think we're going to flip-flop that with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
All right.
Another pair duo. In fact, the three movies that we're watching right now, Easy Rider, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and Midnight Cowboy, are all movies about two people finding each other or coming together in this. Mm-hmm. And I think Easy Rider and Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid really complement one another in that they're so far apart in views of how filmmaking can be made. Mm-hmm. So I want to see that next, just to kind of compare them side by side. And then we'll follow that up with Midnight Cowboy, the only X-rated film ever to receive an Oscar. And then we'll wrap up the Something of 69 with Once Upon a Time in the West, which features Henry Fonda, the father of Peter Fonda.
Peter Fonda's daddy.
Peter
Fonda's daddy.
Yeah.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's episode of Zach on Film. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Hope you enjoy watching Easy Rider so you can kind of follow along with our discussion. Head over to majorspoilers.com where you can find this podcast posting page and then give all of your thoughts on Easy Rider that you've had after watching it or just anything that we've discussed in there. Keep the conversation going in the comments over there. While you're at Major Spoilers, enjoy all of the great content, comic book, more podcasts than you can handle. but you should probably listen to them all because you'll love each and every one of them. While you're there, click on the Amazon.com link where you can do all of your good Amazon shopping, buy a book, buy a movie, buy a pencil. I'm saying I need to buy a new pencil. It's not going to cost you any extra when you do that, but a little bit. We'll come back to major spoilers so you can keep all these great, good podcasts coming right into your ears. Steven, there's also a new Patreon that people should know about.
Patreon.com/major spoilers. If you found some value in this show, please show your appreciation by going to patreon.com/major spoilers. Every little bit helps, and you can contribute as little or as much as you want. Like I said, everything goes back right into the podcasts and the website and ensures that you're able to get good entertainment each and every day.
All right. So next week, we're talking Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That'll be up next week on Zach on Film.
This podcast is copyright 2016 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.